It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. In your health on this Monday morning, we have a story about villains and heroes.
Prisoner 819 is being punished, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Prisoner 819 being punished. In 1971, at Stanford University, a young psychology professor simulated a prison. Some of the young men playing the guards became sadistic, even violent, and the experiment had to be stopped. The results of the Stanford prison experiment showed that people tend to conform, even when that means otherwise good people doing terrible things. Since then, the experiment has been used to help explain everything from Nazi Germany to Abu Ghraib. And now, in a new project, the psychologist who created the prison experiment is trying to show that people can learn to bring out the best in themselves rather than the worst. KQED's Amy Standen reports from San Francisco.
It was 40 years ago that Philip Zimbardo created the Stanford Prison Experiment, but he says he's still hearing about it.
I hate the idea that the Stanford Prison Study is the main, you know, the main thing most people know me for.
Zimbardo has done many things. He was a professor of psychology at Stanford University for 40 years. He's been president of the American Psychological Association. He's written a book about the psychology of time and established a clinic for shy people. But he says these other achievements are often overlooked.
As soon as people meet me, like I go around the world, oh, you're the prison guy, or, you know, I'm checking into a hotel, you know, and there's a receptionist. I mentioned my name, Zimbardo. Aren't you the one who did aren't you the one who created that prison?
Here's how the experiment worked. Zimbardo recruited 24 male college students, paid them $15 a day to spend 2 weeks in a fake prison in a basement on the Stanford campus. Half of the students were assigned to be guards. The others were prisoners.
What happened surprised everyone, including Zimbardo.
This clip comes from an educational video made about the experiment.
Once you put a uniform on and are given a role saying your job is to keep these people in line, then you're not certainly not the same person as if you were in street clothes and in a different role.
Some of the guards in the experiment became abusive. Prisoners showed signs of mental breakdown. After 6 days, Zimbardo shut the experiment down, sent everyone home. His reputation was sealed. He was the guy who had revealed that normal people can do very bad things. If you expose them to wrongdoing, even evil, they'll join in.
So here I am, this evil scientist, creating this situation where evil is dominating good.
The problem is, Zimbardo doesn't see himself that way. He sees himself as a force of good in the world, not evil. And so now, retired from teaching at the age of 78, he has a new project, one that aims to change his legacy in a dramatic way, to turn regular people into heroes. Not comic book heroes, but rather someone who would have helped Jews escape from the Holocaust, or even something more ordinary, like standing up for a classmate who's being bullied.
Heroes are not extraordinary people. They are ordinary people who do an extraordinary thing, step out of themselves, put their best self forward in service to humanity. And it starts with internalizing heroic imagination, namely, I could do it.
So he's calling it the Heroic Imagination Project. It's a nonprofit training organization based in San Francisco. One of the first programs has been to teach heroism at a high school, a charter school called Arise, in one of the tougher neighborhoods of Oakland, California. The instructor in the heroism course is Clint Wilkins. Over the course of the year, he's been teaching the students to recognize how their environment can shape their behavior.
As you can see, there are two kinds of ways of conforming, right? Do you guys remember which they are?
Conformity is not an abstract concept to these students. 2 years ago, the bystander effect happened not far from here. A 16-year-old girl was gang-raped by at least six men during a homecoming dance. Dozens of kids watched. Some of them sent texts to their friends telling them to come check it out. It took 2 hours before anyone called the police. So this class is about training kids to break away from the pack, to be the person who defies conformity and does the right thing. Philip Johnson is a senior in the heroism class.
They had to see the girl. You know, they had to see the girl go in the back with all those guys. And if I see a group of guys in a circle or something, I'm going to go over there and say, oh, what's going on here? And if I see what's going on, you know, it's like, oh, wow. But that didn't happen, apparently.
The other students fall silent. Like Philip Johnson, they'd like to think they would have been the one to call the cops. But if there's one lesson to be learned from this class, it's this. You aren't always the person you think you're going to be. Being able to imagine a different life for yourself is part of this school, and it's the point of the heroism course. It seems to be taking hold in Brandon Amaro. He's a sweet-faced 16-year-old who grew up in a farm town in Southern California. Brandon says sometimes he feels like he could do something really exceptional with his life, something even his parents might not know he's capable of. But then he starts having doubts. He says it's as if there are two Brandons.
The good one? It's like an over-energetic bee in my ear, always buzzing and buzzing and buzzing, telling me, you can do it, go for it.
Then there's the bad one.
Like the one who's kind of like pressing down on your shoulders. He sees like something good, and he's like, no, you can't try.
Brandon says when he imagines himself grown up, he's just not so conflicted anymore.
The older me is going to be much more mature, more confident. He's going to walk, and everybody's going to just know it's him. He's going to know who he is.
Psychologist Philip Zimbardo says he sees himself in these kids. After all, he grew up poor, too.
Growing up on welfare, in poverty, in the ghetto, in the South Bronx, amidst evil, drugs and prostitution and gangs and violence, and I rose above that. In some mystical way, I have always been the leader.
But the question is, why did Zimbardo rise above? Why does anybody become a leader or a hero and someone else becomes a follower or worse? And do we have a choice? Philip Zimbardo's class is teaching the students that they do. But other social psychologists believe humans are more hardwired than that. For example, they say criminal behavior comes from individual differences in personality, things like lack of self-control, differences we're either born with or things we never learned as children. Augustine Brannigan, who studies criminal behavior at the University of Calgary, is one of these people. I asked him what he thinks of the idea of a heroism class.
Whether you can teach them to become heroes? No. What you can do is you can expose them to the narratives about heroes. If it takes, it takes. If it doesn't, they still have the narrative and they'll respect it. But that doesn't mean that it'll change their behavior.
Philip Zimbardo aims to prove this wrong. He's betting that by studying heroic narratives, learning about human nature, and taking on community service projects, the students actually will change the way they act. One afternoon, while the students are in their heroism class, a fight breaks out in the hallway. Not students, but some neighborhood kids, possibly gang-affiliated, drift in from the street, start causing trouble. A teacher calls 911.
I just want to make sure you're helping out with whatever situation just happened at Arise. Thank you.
The students in the heroic imagination class cluster in the doorway, craning their necks to get a better look. And when they return to their seats, they begin to wonder. Maybe this was exactly one of those opportunities they'd been talking about, a chance to step up, to be a hero. But it all happened so fast, and no one did anything. Senior Philip Johnson.
Students could have like been like, you know, somebody come get this person, or it shouldn't have been a group of people watching, you know.
On the other hand, others argue maybe having a teacher call the police was exactly the right thing to do. There's no sense jumping into a brawl if you're just going to get hurt. Sometimes they say it's hard to tell when's the right time to do something extraordinary and when it's better just to stay on the sidelines. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
And that's your health on this Independence Monday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. And now let's go to the big business of palm oil. Environmentalists have been turning their attention in recent years to tropical rainforests in Southeast Asia, where vast areas are being cut down to make way for palm oil plantations. This oil is a common ingredient in many of the foods we eat. It's often used as a substitute for trans fats, which nobody wants to eat anymore. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has the story of some young environmentalists here in the United States who are trying to focus attention on this issue. They've started by targeting palm oil use in Girl Scout cookies.
Rhiannon Tamtishin and Madison Vorva are passionate about orangutans. 4 years ago, the Michigan girls started studying them for a Girl Scout project.
I liked them at first because they are such a cute animal, but they are also helpless. Their rainforest, their home, is being cleared for these palm oil plantations, and they have no say in it.
In two decades, companies have cut down millions of acres of rainforest to plant palm trees and meet the skyrocketing demand for oil and biofuel. This releases huge amounts of greenhouse gases and shrinks habitat for rare animals like tigers, elephants, and rhinos. The girls decided to do whatever they could to tell others about orangutans' plight. Their first step was to stop eating food with palm oil in it. Madison says that's when they learned something that horrified them.
It was Girl Scout cookie season, and we checked the ingredients, and palm oil was an ingredient in the Girl Scout cookies. And I remember just being so shocked and upset.
Palm oil became ubiquitous in U.S. supermarkets a few years ago. Companies put it in baked goods, margarine, and candy as an alternative to hydrogenated oils that contain trans fat. That's not to say palm oil is health food. It's full of saturated fat, but it's cheap. In many places in the world, it has become the staple cooking oil. The girls worked with environmental groups, gathered signatures, and talked to lots of reporters. Finally, a few weeks ago, they got a sit-down meeting with Girl Scout leaders. Madison says they made an impassioned plea to take palm oil out of Girl Scout cookies.
I kind of teared up during the meeting because I care about this so much. And we showed them pictures of orangutans killed for the palm oil industry. And I think those pictures, you know, really resonated with me as a young kid, but also today.
Girl Scouts of the USA cares deeply about the environment. So, you know, of course, it was of concern.
Amanda Haymaker manages cookie sales for the organization. She says her bakers tell her they need palm oil to make the cookies taste great and resist crumbling and spoiling. And so far, there is no affordable source of sustainable palm oil. Haymaker told Madison and Rhiannon that it's too late to change the recipe for next year's cookies.
I mean, the cookie boxes have been printed.
Haymaker says she won't do anything to jeopardize cookie sales because Scouts need the money for camp, trips, and charity projects. But because of Madison and Rhiannon's dedication, she'll consider changing future batches.
We're definitely researching palm oil, and we're going to continue to keep contact with the girls.
And Rhiannon and Madison's campaign has drawn attention all the way in Southeast Asia. During a recent visit to Washington, D.C., Malaysia Plantation Minister Bernard Dompok said stories about destruction of the rainforest and orangutans are misleading.
We have enough laws in the country to prevent all this.
For instance, Dompok says Malaysia has pledged to keep half of its land forested.
I think it's time perhaps that some of these little girls get better informed on these things.
Dan saat ini Indonesia sendiri punya.
Indonesia Agriculture Minister Siswano added that his country set up a conservation area for orangutans a few years ago, and it just announced a moratorium on converting primary forests to palm plantations. Conservation groups say these policies still allow destruction of rainforests, but they do indicate progress. And there are other signs that sustainable palm oil is starting to pick up momentum. For example, Kellogg's announced for every ton of oil it uses around the globe, it will subsidize sustainable palm oil. The company owns the biggest baker of Girl Scout cookies. Kellogg says when an affordable source of sustainable palm oil becomes available, the company will buy it. Doug Boucher is a tropical forest expert for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He gives Madison and Rhiannon a lot of credit.
I'm one of those grown-ups that hasn't been as successful as they have.
Boucher predicts Girl Scout cookies soon will become rainforest friendly because two teenagers wanted to save orangutans. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
Okay, you may think of July 4th as Independence Day, but to competitive eaters, this is the day of Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest on New York City's Coney Island. It remains among America's most popular foods, the hot dog, judging by the speed with which the hot dogs disappeared at the Inskeep family reunion over the weekend in Indiana. But not many of us know why we call them hot dogs. Our own Renee Montaigne spoke with linguist Ben Zimmer.
Let's start with what often is the fun part of these searches, and that's the misinformation of how it came to be called a hot dog.
There's a bunch of myths out there, possibly the most popular one, involves a cartoonist for the New York Evening Journal named Tad Dorgan. And the story goes that around 1901, Tad Dorgan was at the Polo Grounds, which is in Upper Manhattan. It's where New York's baseball giants used to play. He was at the ball game. One of the concessionaires was selling Red Hots, these Frankfurter sausages. And he had the idea to make a cartoon with a dachshund in a role. And so he drew this picture for his cartoon. But then supposedly he couldn't spell the word dachshund. And so he just wrote hot dog instead. This has been a very sturdy myth, even though there's not a bit of truth to this story.
And tell us about one man who really is given credit for being the original hot dog man.
Well, there's a figure that has emerged from some recent research. Yale Law librarian Fred Shapiro, an intrepid word sleuth, has uncovered mention of hot dogs in Paterson, New Jersey, in a paper from December 1892, before it shows up anywhere else, as far as we know. And in Paterson, New Jersey, there was a man named Thomas Francis Xavier Morris, who was nicknamed Hot Dog Morris, who would go around, and he was a Frankfurter vendor, and he would go and sell hot dogs to people when they were skating on an ice pond or at circuses or anywhere where people were gathering. And he was known in Paterson as the Hot Dog Man. And so it's interesting that Paterson, New Jersey might actually be the key to figuring out where this term hot dog came from.
Well, if he was written up in the local newspaper, he must have been pretty well known there.
He was very well known locally, and in fact, he had this remarkable life going around Europe as a strongman before marrying a European woman, coming to the United States, and eventually settling in Paterson. He opened a restaurant, and then he started selling his Frankfurters, and he was known as Hot Dog Morris, sometimes also called Pepper Sauce Morris, because he liked to put pepper sauce as his special condiment on the food that he sold.
So nothing's certain, as is so often the case with the origins of language, but have you been able to pinpoint what you would consider its the real origin of the hot dog?
I like to think that perhaps Hot Dog Morris had a big role to play in popularizing it, maybe even coming up with the term hot dog. He had such an interesting life. He had spent time in Germany. Maybe that gave him a special knack in the Frankfurter department. And he came to Paterson, which was a city of innovation. And, you know, it would be great to think that perhaps he was the innovator in calling it a hot dog and marketing it that way. There are other early reports of hot dogs being sold in the shore towns of New Jersey, like Asbury Park and Atlantic City. So it could be a New Jersey origin, which appeals to me because I'm a New Jersey boy born and bred. And so it would be nice to see New Jersey get the credit for this one.
Ben, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Ben Zimmer is the executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus online magazine.
Hot dog. It's NPR. Republican presidential candidates will not be the only politicians working during this holiday week. Rather than take a recess as they normally would, the U.S. Senate will be in session this week. It was that or face criticism from voters that members were away celebrating the 4th while the nation's credit rating is at risk. Also working is NPR's Cokie Roberts, who joins us most Monday mornings. Cokie, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Nice to be back.
Yeah, happy Independence Day to you.
Same to you. Happy 4th.
So Senate leaders canceled this recess, but does that mean they're making any progress?
They're pretty cranky, actually, about being here this week, and they know that it's really more about symbolism than substance, so that makes them even crankier. But the truth is that the meetings convened by Vice President Biden have gone a long way toward solving the problem of trying to raise the ceiling on the national debt while making some cuts in the deficit. So it's now up to the leaders on both sides, the leaders in Congress and the president, to finish it. We heard some tiny movement from Republican leaders yesterday. Arizona's John McCain talked about revenue raisers without being specific. Texas's John Cornyn said that he would be open to eliminating tax breaks and corporate subsidies. And of course, the Senate has darted down that path with eliminating tax breaks for ethanol. So if they could find others, it would give the Democrats some cover and be able to say, so they could say that it's not just cuts from programs their constituents care about that have happened. And so far, that has been the case. So far, Republicans have been basically winning on all of these big votes, getting cuts without any tax increases. The Democrats need something to take home.
Well, the president, President Obama, is saying he wants a deal by July 22nd. That's less than 3 weeks away now. Is that realistic?
Well, it depends on what the real drop-dead date is for the debt running out, the ability to pay our bills running out. The Treasury Department says it's August 2nd. The president is trying to get Congress to act before that so it really does not come to a crisis or a temporary default, which some people are talking about. There is some talk now of a mini deal instead of doing the whole big thing that would hold over through the next election so that we are not in this crisis mode all the way through next year. And maybe that's what will happen instead of some big grand scheme. But I would suspect August 2nd will be the date, not July 22nd.
Cokie, I want to ask you a question as someone who's covered Congress for... Well, how long have you covered Congress, Cokie?
Oh, basically decades, Steve. Just forever and ever.
35 years, ever since you were about 7, I believe.
Yeah, right.
And you've also written books about the Founding Fathers. Here we are on Independence Day, and we're living in the world that they created. How would they respond, do you think, to the way that Congress is acting now?
I think they'd recognize it completely. John Adams wrote a letter from the Continental Congress to his wife, Abigail, who was desperate for him to come home because she was having to take care of everything on her own. And he wrote and said, very sarcastically, "I am surrounded by great men who talk and talk and talk." So this is not something that would be foreign to them at all, I think. You know, the one thing that you can say, though, is that in the end, with great difficulty, those men were able to compromise. I mean, that's what the Constitution is a great compromise. And maybe this Congress could take a lesson from that.
Cokie, always a pleasure talking with you.
Nice to be with you, Steve.
NPR's Cokie Roberts joins us most Monday mornings. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
In a little under a month from today, on August 2nd, the Treasury Department warns the U.S. won't be able to pay its bills. Money to pay interest on loans from other countries, money to pay Social Security checks, Medicare bills, and so on. Now, since America's founding 235 years ago tomorrow, our government has run up a debt of $14.3 trillion, and every few years, Congress has voted to raise the limit on that debt. But this year, it's different. Many congressional Republicans say, enough, cut up the credit card, and start dealing with the consequences. It's a compelling argument. So much debt seems downright irresponsible, right? Well, the problem is that the global economic system depends in large part on borrowing and the ability to pay it back. And unless Congress raises the debt limit, no one can say for sure what the consequences might be. From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. And our cover story today, the danger of default. We'll hear from two leading members of Congress on where the negotiations stand, but first, a plausible scenario. Economics reporter Annie Lowry writes for Slate.com, and she interviewed dozens of Wall Street analysts to find out what the morning of August 2nd might actually look like.
First, what's going to happen is that the value of Treasury bonds is going to go down. People are going to start selling them because they're not going to want to hold them. There's going to be a flight to safety. And the only thing that's safer in the entire global financial world than Treasuries is cash. So people are going to start hoarding cash. After that, businesses are going to have a lot of trouble with their short-term funding. The entire economy is going to slow down because all of the funding mechanisms are going to be disrupted. Foreign investors are going to stop investing. American investors are going to stop investing. And you could actually see the entire U.S. economy go into a recession just because of a financial crisis again.
Slate.com's business reporter Annie Lowry with a worst-case scenario. Now, before you start building that survival bunker, Peter Morici, an economist at the University of Maryland, says that scenario and the Treasury Department's August 2nd deadline are scare tactics. In fact, he says, with some creative juggling, the government will do just fine for at least 2 more years without raising the debt limit.
The government will still be collecting taxes. Those are enough to cover more than half its expenses. And from that, it can easily pay the interest on the national debt. In fact, it can put out Social Security checks, make Medicare payments, and even most defense expenses.
You are essentially saying the U.S. government right now has enough tax revenues to cover things like interest, Social Security, Medicare, most of defense spending. But for how long?
Well, it could cover those expenses almost indefinitely because it can collect the taxes and just make those expenses. But, of course, what happens to the other functions of government? There are other levers it can pull. For example, the Treasury can print money. Now, that would put a lot of money in circulation. But the Federal Reserve is sitting on a big reservoir of government bonds and can essentially sell those bonds and absorb that money back in. And through that mechanism, we could keep the government going another year at its present level.
It sounds like what you're proposing is to simply kick the can down the road.
I'm not proposing that we do it. I would prefer that we solve this month. But if we can't solve it this month, there is no reason for the United States of America to default. There's a plan B.
You're saying that August 2nd is an arbitrary date, but you're also saying that the debt limit should be raised, but there's no rush to do it. It can be done now. It can be done in 6 months. It can be done in a year.
I can only look at the numbers and the resources that are available. They have options after August 2nd.
That's Peter Morici. He's a professor at the University of Maryland's Robert H. Smith School of Business. Professor Morici, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, it's safe to say Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat, does not share Morici's view.
Ultimately, it means that with the dollars we have, we'll have to choose among the options of sending out Social Security checks or paying for prison guards or paying for food safety inspections or paying soldiers or paying veterans benefits. But even worse, perhaps, even than that, and that's pretty unimaginable, is that it could cause the whole financial system to crash, and it certainly will hurt our standing in the world.
Many Democrats have been accusing Republicans of playing politics, but let me ask you this question. I mean, many Republicans are saying, our voters will not allow me to back this. Certainly the freshman Republicans in the House, they ran on this platform. Can you blame them for not wanting to back it?
Their job, they're now elected officials. Their job is to educate their voters and to do the right thing. And the right thing, as regrettable as it is for everybody to vote for raising the debt ceiling, is to raise the debt ceiling. And we're not saying we're going to incur more debt. We're saying we've got to pay the bills that we have pledged that we would pay.
Senator Brown, you and four other Democratic senators sent a letter to the vice president recently, basically urging him to keep Medicare off the table in any kind of debt limit negotiations with Republicans. Is that a deal breaker for you? Are deep cuts in Medicare a deal breaker for you?
Deep cuts in Medicare, I think, are a deal, certainly for me, and I think for a large swath of the Democratic caucus. And I think for the American public, the Republicans insist on cuts, on very, very severe cuts, on only 18% of the budget, that non-defense discretionary spending. Most are unwilling to talk with any seriousness about the defense budget. Most are unwilling to talk with any seriousness about any kind of revenues, including closing tax loopholes, eliminating the subsidies for the oil industry, and repealing the special tax breaks for Wall Street hedge funds.
If those same Republicans are unwilling to consider some of those revenue-raising measures, and some Democrats are unwilling to talk about serious spending cuts, how are you going to reach a compromise?
We're willing to make major cuts. The vice president's already negotiated that with the Republicans. We just think defense needs to be on the table, and ending some of these outrageous tax breaks for Wall Street and big oil and outsourcing jobs.
Bottom line, Sherrod Brown, are you confident that the debt ceiling will be raised before August 2nd?
Yeah, I am. I have enough confidence in John Boehner, a fellow Ohioan, lives in a different part of the state from me and subscribes to a very different political philosophy. I'm confident that he will have the skills and will be grown up enough to convince enough Republicans to join with Democrats to do the right thing.
That's Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. Senator Brown, thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Guy. Thank you.
Now, other members of Congress aren't so optimistic, including Jeff Flake. He's a Republican congressman from Arizona. And I asked him if he thinks the U.S. could actually default.
Yes, I think that's a distinct possibility unless we can come to some kind of agreement here.
What would you be willing to do in order to vote for the debt limit to be increased?
Well, I think in the short term, we've got to have some steep spending cuts to discretionary spending, more than we've done so far. In the medium term, we've got to have some kind of caps that will kick in if we fail to hit our spending targets, which we likely will. And for the long term, we need some kind of balanced budget amendment or some mechanism to make sure that we don't continually get into this position.
President Obama this past week said, look, you know, Democrats have dropped their maximalist positions. They're willing to make a painful spending cuts. Republicans have to drop their maximalist positions on certain tax increases. Could you conceive of a deal where there might be some tax increases and you would still back an increase in the debt ceiling?
You know, we as House Republicans have already signed on to a budget which would lower the rates but expand the base and would increase revenue. So I think we recognize that we need to increase revenue for the Treasury. I don't think that has to come in the form of increased tax rates. But Republicans, I think, also need to get over the opposition to some defense cuts. I think we're going to inevitably have to cut some defense. But on the Democratic side, there seems to be an unwillingness to really cut spending.
If Congress cannot reach an agreement and the U.S. does actually go into default, are you worried that the public could blame congressional Republicans?
They could. Certainly with the government shutdown, the fear among Republicans was that we would get the lion's share of the blame. And that put us in a pretty poor negotiating position. And that's why the cuts were pretty paltry. In this case, I think the lion's share of the blame would likely go to the White House. I think the administration knows that they're in the driver's seat here.
Are you confident that a deal will be reached soon?
You know, Congress tends to act right when we hit the fiscal cliff. If you look at the TARP vote or other examples in history, the problem now is we don't know exactly where that cliff is. I think if we were to raise the debt ceiling, then we'd hit that cliff perhaps when we have a Treasury auction and don't have anybody willing to buy our debt. And so that's the difficulty here. There are some who believe that we can go for a while before we raise the debt limit, and some think it needs to be immediate.
What do you think? Do you think that it's pressing? It has to be dealt with now?
I think it certainly behooves us. We should have acted years ago, and we wouldn't be, at this ratio of debt to GDP. Having said that, I think that, those who say that we can only go until August 2nd, probably overstating it a bit. But certainly over the next year, we can't just punt this ball until after the presidential election. So I know that.
That's Arizona Republican Congressman Jeff Flake. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
But if the U.S. is just a month away from default, there is still one question left to answer. Why isn't Wall Street panicking? In fact, the markets just had their best week in 2 years.
I'm a little puzzled by that.
That's Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman.
I'm a little puzzled by how little sign there is of what looks like a looming crisis in the market. People are buying short-term U.S. government debt at very low interest rates. In fact, briefly, they were buying one-month U.S. government debt at a negative interest rate last week. And it's one thing to think that probably something will be worked out. I'm not even sure of that, but to believe that certainly something will be worked out, I don't know. I don't quite get it.
What explains it?
Partly, I think this is completely uncharted. I think it's very hard for people, including market participants, to wrap their heads around the fact that the United States is so close to becoming a dysfunctional banana republic. You still keep on thinking, well, this is America. Things like that can't happen here. And I hope they're right, but I don't have confidence in it.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. Coming up, a scientist in Brooklyn who says one day everyone can eat local seafood. Kansas City bluefin tuna sound good? Stay tuned. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
When baseball's Cincinnati Reds play against the St. Louis Cardinals tonight, it will mark an anniversary of sorts. On this day, 100 years ago, two new players took to the field for the Reds. Both men were born in Cuba, and so they were among the first Latinos to play in the big leagues. It was a time when the color line still kept minorities out of baseball. Jackie Robinson would not integrate the game for another 3 decades, but Rob Ruck, author of the book Raceball, says baseball's businessmen saw talent and profits in Latin America.
Major league clubs often barnstormed and played in Cuba in the winter, and major league ball players, as well as players from the Negro leagues, would go down there each winter to make a living. They saw the level of the talent and simply wanted to use that talent in the major leagues and win and make money from it.
Did people at least privately begin to discuss then the problem, which it surely would have been at that time, of bringing a Cuban ball player or certain Cuban ball players into the major leagues?
There were sporadic efforts and consideration. But in the first half of the 20th century, the color line was accepted, and there were very few in the major leagues in terms of owners who were likely to try to confront that.
Now, who were the men who were the first to be put on a major league team? Rafael Almeida and Armando Marsans. Who were they?
Those were the first two. You have a fellow who pitches for Cincinnati, Adolfo Luque, who is light-skinned. And you have perhaps 30, 40, 50 Cubans who are light enough to pass, who play before Jackie Robinson breaks the color line in 1947.
I just want to underline this. Are you saying that major league teams, once they began recruiting Latino players, went out of their way first to make sure that the guys were light-skinned enough that nobody would really notice?
Sure. It was simply the racial reality that prevailed in this country was an acceptance of segregation. Major league owners might have wanted to use Latin talent, but they were certainly going to play by the realities of the color line.
I'm thinking again of Jackie Robinson in 1947. There was this white owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, Branch Rickey, who knew what he was doing, believed it was the right thing to do, and went about bringing Jackie Robinson onto his baseball team. Was there someone for the Cincinnati Reds, the team that brought on the first Latino players, who consciously said, this is the time to do this, and we're going to figure out the way to get it done?
I don't think 100 years ago when the Reds brought in a couple of Cubans, it had anything to do with notions of racial equality. It simply was the Cincinnati Ball Club trying to find players who would help them win. And even Branch Rickey. While Branch Rickey undoubtedly was trying to do the right thing, Branch Rickey was trying to make money. I think the Pittsburgh Courier captured it best when it said, Jackie's nimble, Jackie's quick, Jackie makes the turnstiles click. Mm. Ball clubs want to bring fans in. They want to win at the gate. They want to win on the field.
So how good were the early Latino players?
The early Latino players were a mixed bag. Probably Adolfo Luque, the pitcher with the Reds, was the best. But the real Latino talent does not appear until after Jackie Robinson opens the door in 1947.
Oh, so even though the door had been opened in this today rather embarrassing way for Latinos, it was opened much wider after 1947.
Robinson not only is the catalyst to the greatest infusion of talent the game had yet to see, African Americans, that wave of talent is followed by an even better one when Orestes Mignoso, Roberto Clemente, Felipe Alou, Juan Marichal begin to appear in the 1950s.
Who was the first Latino player that you would identify who was very open about his identity, didn't care who knew about it or even wore it on his sleeve?
The first who confronts not only racial barriers, but the cultural barriers and stereotypes that Latinos endured, I believe, was Roberto Clemente. He came to Pittsburgh, which was more or less a biracial community, African American and Caucasian. The black community did not accept him as African American. The white community saw him as black. It takes Pittsburgh several years to accept his pride, to accept how outspoken he is. Clemente was a fairly deep intellectual figure, both in terms of his political and social consciousness. So it took a while for these guys to make it. And Major League Baseball, which had been very slow to confront questions of race pertaining to African Americans, did nothing in the 1950s and for most of the 60s to deal with the issues that these young Latino ballplayers who lacked English were facing as they came to the United States.
Can you think of another moment as we move forward through Major League history when it becomes apparent to you, as you have researched the history, that this was a moment at which Latino ballplayers in the Major Leagues was normal, not even a matter for comment anymore?
I think in the 1980s, we start to see a fairly significant cohort of Latino ballplayers. By the late 80s, 10% of all Major League ballplayers are Latino. Today, that's closer to 27%. And I think that Baseball America has come to accept that the game today is indeed a international and multiracial game, far different from what it was a half century ago.
So have Latinos in baseball transformed baseball or transformed what it is?
Latino baseball players, they're disproportionately among the best ball players in the game today. Last season, half of the Silver Slugger Awards, which are given to the best defensive player at each position in the two leagues, went to Latinos. 40% of those selected to the All-Star game were Latin or Hispanic American. The real future of baseball can be found in the 30 academies that major league clubs run in the Dominican Republic, the half dozen in Venezuela, the kids on Nicaraguan sandlots who are desperately trying to develop their skills to attract the attention of a scout and make it to this country.
Rob Ruck is the author of the book Race Ball. He teaches history at the University of Pittsburgh, and we've been talking with him about a piece of baseball history. On July 4th, 1911, one century ago, the first two Latino players made it onto a Major League Baseball team. Mr. Ruck, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.